We'll see what they say about states' rights, right?
We just need one more, always just try to, information.
Can we do that?
It's up to you, the agenda's never in line before.
Yeah, okay, why don't we, call to order, we do not have a quorum at this point, so we'll just do it as, information, okay? Just a question, does anybody have a problem with the agenda?
I'd like to see in addition, information item on the status of bright line quiet zones.
Sure, I think we can.
Okay, right, I'll take it. All right, we'll just add it, and then when we get a quorum, any problems with the minutes of the February 7th meeting? Okay, then we'll move on, comments from the chair, I have no comments, CAC liaison reports.
Sure, just to hand it out in front of you, a few updates I want to give you. So our funding program for local initiatives and transportation alternatives, the application has closed, and we had 11 local initiatives project applications, totaling around $13 million in federal funds, and we have about $20 million available there. And then 8 transportation alternatives applications requesting around $6 million federal funds, and we have around 3.1 there. So we'll be seeing those coming up in the next couple of months for you all to review. And then we also want to note, we're in March now, it's Florida Bicycle Month, so there's plenty of events going on to promote bicycle safety and ridership throughout the county. All those are available on our website. We have a little bit of update later on today to talk more about those events going on and the ones that we participated in. And then I wanted to give one update again from the board committee meeting that just happened last month. I know you all wanted an update on the safety performance measures. There'll be the, I think in fact it has the summary of those board meeting actions, but the safety measures were approved with Vision Zero for 2018, so fatalities and serious injuries, Vision Zero. And then also the recommendation that you all had were also approved, so reviewing our current projects for how well they're implementing safety, and then also to have a Vision Zero action plan provided by next year, early on February next year. So I just wanted to give that update.
Since we have a quorum now, let's take a roll call.
Bruce Bossier? Tomas Boynton? Terry Brown?
Here.
Judy DeVersa is excused. Greg Fagan?
Here.
Michael Fitzpatrick?
Here.
David Flanagan?
Here.
Richard Gonzalez is excused. Glenn Harvey?
Here.
Bill Klein?
Here.
Tina Pena?
Here.
Andrew Thompson is excused. Myra Inman?
Here.
We have one, Mr. Chairman.
Bruce Bastian? Here.
Okay. Motion to adopt the agenda with the change with Michael, who wants to have an update on the quiet zones for Brighton.
I'll make the motion.
With that change?
Yes.
Second?
I'll second.
Terry, second. All in favor? Say
aye.
Opposed? Nay. Okay. Motion to approve the minutes of February 7th.
So moved. Second.
Myron and Bill William. All in favor? Say aye.
Aye.
We've done the comments from the chair, liaison. I haven't seen anybody from the public.
Can I ask a question about the liaison's written report?
Sure.
That's the request, number 4, the request to FHWA for interim approval to paint the bicycle lanes mean. What does interim approval mean? I mean, if you get approval, you paint it, but what happens if you get interim approval?
Sure.
Do you paint them and then have to unpaint them?
Someone has to pay for them.
I think our director can explain that one in more detail. I don't have a good answer. I mean, mean, the Federal Highway Administration creates a document they call the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices. And stuff they feel confident is here to stay goes into the manual, and stuff that they see value in between major updates, they create this interim process that says, in between major updates, if you'd like to do this, you have to tell us you're going to do it, and then we give you a letter saying you're allowed. I don't know why they do it that way, frankly. This one, you know, the interim approval was established in 2011, so it's not like this is a new thing. Cities all over the country have been doing it for the last 7 years.
Yeah.
What we're highlighting is that Palm Beach County just recently filed their request to have this interim approval extended to county roads. So that's the one kind of local change.
That would be county roads that pass through municipalities as well. Anywhere there's a bike lane.
Yes.
That's already established, was it?
So they would be permitted to paint the lanes. Okay. And just background to that, we had a conversation. David Ricks is the new county engineer. He and I were talking, along with Steve Carrier, their assistant county engineer, about some of their resurfacing projects. And we had suggested, hey, when you're putting in the final stripes for your new resurfaced roadways, why don't you narrow the lanes and designate the shoulders as bike lanes? And while you're out there, paint the area between the through lane and the turn lanes green to highlight the vehicular bicycle conflicts. And Steve Carrier responded, we aren't allowed to do that. We don't have the approval from Federal Highway. So David said, how do we get that? So I wrote him a letter that he could sign, and he turned it into Federal Highway. So it's progress.
Yeah.
So that's how the sausage gets made sometimes.
Very helpful.
Any other comments on the liaison's report? Okay. All right. The only one, FDOT's going to hold a public hearing on Express Phase 3B2. Is that the toll lanes on 95 going from Blades to Linton?
Yes.
That is the toll.
Okay.
Thank you. All right. First action item, only action item, is to recommend for us to review and decide to recommend Amendment 4 to fiscal year 18-22 of the Transportation Improvement Program.
So in your packet, you'll see this table on this agenda item, and also a letter we received from FDOT. So this is the State Road 7 extension on a priority list. It was number one on a priority list. From 60th Street to North Lake Boulevard. And the reason why this amendment is coming forward to you all today is this funding, these funding phases for construction and right-of-way were originally programmed for 2017 and that fiscal year. So they were in the previous version of the TIP, the Transportation Improvement Program, that you all have seen before in 2017-21, and never went into the 2018. Well, those funds in the space for construction right-of-way were never programmed in 2017, right? So they never let out the bid and award a contract for construction. So those funds are now being rolled over to 2018, and it's expected that there will be advertisement and be approved sometime this month. So this project should not roll forward again in fiscal year 19 for those phases. It is expected to be in 2018, but for today, an amendment for these funds go from 17 to 2018. And there's a few other cost changes along the way that we've seen in the last years, and that's the important thing. And that's it.
Okay. Questions?
I have three questions about this. I'm a little puzzled. One was the purpose. How is it that right-of-way funds are expended 3 years after construction?
I believe the purpose for that, and I think Nick can probably correct me if I'm wrong, but basically there's like a quicker right-of-way acquisition phase, but it may come back later sometimes to deal with. So they want to expedite the process and not get held legally. They'll have like a quicker right-of-way acquisition phase, right? And program funds towards that. transfers before they write the final check. So they can build on the property, but they may still have to make a payment to a property owner.
I have to tell you, my second question was, the right-of-way costs from the previous version of this have more than doubled. And I've been following this project for, I don't know, a dozen years. And a few years ago, when it first got on the tip, the right-of-way costs were something like $250,000. Now they're more than $2 million. I have looked at the right-of-way and where the road is to be built. And there are only something like, either the state or the county owns the entire right-of-way except for about 1,000 square feet. And I've never understood why there are such enormous right-of-way costs for this project. That's my basic question. The other question is just figures here are presented with seven significant digits. This is one of my hobby horses that I love to ride every once in a while. There's absolutely no way that you can project the construction costs are to seven or eight significant digits, and I wonder if this process isn't overwhelmed by the terror of computers. The computers will print out something to as many significant digits as you want, but they don't make any sense. It gives you a sense of presenting things with so many significant digits gives you the impression of great precision, and that precision is not there. So I just like to say that every once in a while because it gets under my skin. In my work life, I dealt with a $250 million budget, which was built up from something like anywhere 450 projects. And we never did this sort of thing, never presented it to any decision maker with seven significant digits, which is crazy.
Yeah, but that was when you were using the Atlas.
No, we're using computers.
Andrew, I think this my question's for you. The source of these numbers is what organization?
This would be through FDOT, correct.
So FDOT generates these numbers?
Yes.
Okay.
And they do periodical cost estimate, updated cost estimate. So the closer it gets to actual, like the actual fiscal year that's been implemented, so like 2018 is going to be your most accurate out of.
This is 2018, right?
Yep.
So it's projected cost, not what you write the check for when it's finished. Could be more or less.
Right, it's nice stuff you're up there, right?
Sure, go ahead. So they have a cost estimate, yes, and then it'll go out to bid and it's whatever, you know, they get off of. You know. If it comes back too high, they might reevaluate it.
It's just something I have to say periodically because it suggests a level of precision in understanding and projecting costs which is not there.
Right.
Agreed. The more fundamental, I would really appreciate it if someone could find out for me the details of the right-of-way costs.
Last year, if I remember, this project was not able to be funded because of certain approvals hadn't been gotten, and the funding from this project was taken and put on Southern Boulevard. Could you explain what happened from there back to this?
Do you remember? I mean, that is correct.
As I understood it, before it was federal money.
But this is they are still using some federal funding on this project. Yes. So what you see there is the SASA, Surface Transportation Funds, and then the ACSA is going to be Advanced Surface Transportation Funds. So those are both more or less federal funds.
Going to your question. When this project was programmed in 2017, portion of this $40 million for construction was funded with federal sources, not state sources.
Right.
And what we did last year was we took the federal money on this project and we put it on Southern Boulevard and its widening because all the permits were in hand and it was able to encumber those dollars. We took the state money that was on the Southern Boulevard budget and we put it here.
Right.
Okay. We did that as a swap within the same fiscal year, $17 on State Road 7 went to 7, $17 on Southern went to State Road 7.
Okay.
What we're doing with this request is saying that the state wasn't able to award a contract in fiscal year 17. They would like to move these funds from 17 into 18. These state dollars, these, I mean, if you focus on the biggest numbers, it's the $40 million of state dollars to construct the project that they're asking us to roll into fiscal year 18. And as Andrew mentioned, their project schedule says they hope to advertise for construction bids in the end of this month and to award a construction contract prior to June 30th. Ideally, it's in April, but we'll see.
So you're not adding, you're shifting.
These are funds that were fully programmed and should have been consumed in 17. These dollars, after the switch, these dollars were on this project. They were just in a previous year.
So this is just a letter to acknowledge that.
All we're saying is DOT sent us a letter saying we couldn't spend the money last year. Would you please let us move the money into fiscal year 18 and reflect it in fiscal year 18?
Okay, so DDR and DES is state money.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
So it's a no-brainer.
It's a
no-brainer.
Well, it's a project. Yeah, it's our number one priority project, our major project list. So we as a governing board and we as staff, because our governing board said it's a great idea to build this, have no objection to this request. We want the project to get awarded and built.
Okay. I guess one other thing to clarify is we usually come forward to you all right after we approve our TIP with something called a roll forward. So if you remember the first amendment to review for the TIP for 18 to 22, was called that roll forward, and that's taken those 17 funds from a lot of projects that didn't get programmed.
Didn't get spent. Or encumbered.
Yes, correct. They were encumbered.
They were programmed in 17. They were not encumbered in 17, so they get brought into 18.
Yep. And this is actually one that should have been caught earlier. It should have been in that original roll forward.
Okay. Any other questions about this project?
Are they going to bring light pipelines?
What?
So are they going to bring light pipelines?
Right. I see water.
No pipelines.
How many years have been? I don't know, 10, 15?
Do you understand why? Other than the fact that they did?
To squeeze it further, to make a smaller cross section.
Okay.
Right. Minimize the environmental implications.
Right. Any other comments? We need a motion on this project. Who would like to make that motion?
Make a motion.
To approve.
Second. Greg, second.
So, Dean, you make a motion to recommend the plan.
Yes.
Greg, seconded. Any other comments? All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Against the motion?
Nay.
Just one nay?
Abstain.
Okay. All right. Do we want to talk about the quiet zones now or the United Planning Work Program? Which do you want to do first?
I'll do this. I'll do it about both items.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Once you get the remote ready, you can go. So, perfect. Good afternoon, everyone. Just in case I haven't introduced myself already, my name is Nick Urban, and I am here on behalf of our Deputy Director of Program Development, Renee Cross, who have been presenting the Unified Planning Work Program, but you get me instead. She's out sick today. Before I dive into this document, I'll give you the brief update on the Quiet Zones. The short story is we have a reimbursement agreement with Brightline where they're going to build additional gates, what we call supplemental safety measures, in the form of exit gates at 34 of the 80 crossings that roads that cross the FEC railway in Palm Beach County. Their most recent update to their commitment to us said they will be done with the exit gates in West Palm Beach by the end of next week, and that they will be done with the exit gates between the rest of Palm Beach County by the end of the month. That's their updated construction commitment to us. Now, I'm not managing their contractor, so I'm not, you know, don't shoot the messenger if we miss those dates. We're working as, we're applying as much pressure as we can to them to prioritize their labor efforts on getting these gates done. Once they're done, the next step for each of our cities is to go out and validate that they have been installed and that they work. So you stand at a crossing, you watch a train approach, you make sure the gates come down on both sides of the road now, not just one side. Once you've validated that everything's been installed and working, then the cities file what's called a notice of establishment with the Federal Rail Administration saying we want to designate our part of the corridor as a quiet zone. When they file that piece of paper and all of the stacks of supporting documents that it requires, the FRA gets that, and there's a 21-day burn-in period. Now, that's not an approval period. It doesn't give the FRA a chance to reject a filing, except for if the they can't reject a filing that's consistent with the federal law. There's no subjectivity to it. There's no, nobody at FRA sits there and says, is this a good idea or not? If it meets the requirements of the law, the filing becomes effective 21 days later and the quiet zone is in place. So right now our hope is that our cities will be able to file those notices the first week of April, and by the end of April, the quiet zone will be in place for all of our, for the entire corridor from West Palm to Broward County. That's the best update I can give you at this point.
I'm sorry, if you want to go first.
My question is, if, say, the city of West Palm does their job and applies, and Lake Worth doesn't, and Boynton doesn't, Delray doesn't, do the horns go out in individual cities, or are you going to wait till their horns go out for the whole corridor at one time?
So the train horn federal regulation says you have to blow when you get to a crossing, and a local government can file a notice for a quiet zone for any section of railroad that's at least a half mile long. In Palm Beach County, the approach we've taken is that we've done all of the calculations on the risk factors on a city by city basis. So West Palm can file, they're at least a half mile long, and they can create that portion of the corridor as a quiet zone. If Lake Worth, for some reason, chooses not to file, that portion would require the operator of the train to then blow their horns as they cross each of the roadways in Lake Worth. And then if Lantana chooses to file, the operator would stop blowing their horn at those three crossings, and then they would get to Boynton, and they would, and they have a schedule. They know exactly where they are on the tracks, and they know which one of those crossings require them to blow their horn. And they're very good at following that rule, because it's a big deal to break the rule. So as they go down, when they reach a crossing that has, that requires a horn, they blow it. And just by way of example, to help you understand that this is a city-by-city decision, on the Tri-Rail system, when Tri-Rail double-tracked the entire corridor from Miami to West Palm, they included the additional, or what we call supplemental safety measures, necessary for every part of that corridor to be a quiet zone. Every city in the corridor filed the required paperwork, except Pompano Beach. So the irony is, the headquarters of SFRTA are in Pompano Beach, and every time a Tri-Rail train pulls by the headquarters during one of their board meetings, it blows its horn, and you have to stop talking for about, you know, 15 to 30 seconds while that train goes by, because you can't hear yourself. So every city has the opportunity to do it on their own. That's my bottom line. Mr. Brown.
Well, I'm going past the quiet zone and the gates, but there are certain areas, just off the top of my head, I know that 23rd Street and Boynton Beach has a lot of pedestrian traffic with children, and of course Atlantic Avenue has all that party traffic in the evenings. How far along, is it the city's responsibility to do the side fencing to prevent people from trying to go around the gates, or is it the part of the quiet zone construction? I mean, the area I'm thinking of in Boynton Beach,
yeah.
23rd, and also Ocean Avenue.
Yeah.
I mean, people are going to walk by there if it's not closed off.
So here's the reality. The Quiet Zone Calculator requires you to block cars from driving around the entry gate by putting either a median or an exit gate across the roadway so they can't get in front of the train. Any place we have sidewalks, we also have gates on those sidewalks, pedestrian gates, that say to a pedestrian or a bicyclist that's using the sidewalk, a train is coming, you don't belong on the tracks right now. The railroad is not obligated to put up any corridor fencing, nor is any local government obligated to put up any corridor fencing. In fact, people are not permitted legally to cross the tracks away from a roadway. So when people are walking across the tracks in between two roadways, they're essentially trespassing, and they're acting in an illegal and an unsafe manner by putting themselves in front of a train. That being said, if a city wants to find space for the installation of fencing, and when I say find space, what I mean is somebody owns the dirt you put the fence on.
Yeah.
Is it the railroad? If so, they're going to want you to file for an easement, and they're going to want you to pay them to use their land for that purpose. And they're going to want you to maintain that fence once it's installed. If it's not the railroad, then you need to either have a public right-of-way adjacent to the rail corridor, which is true in some places in Palm Beach County, and the owner of that public road would have to agree to allow the fence to be installed on their side of the property line. Or you would need a private property owner to agree to let you install along, you know, their parcel of land or parcels. But you need permission from the person or entity that owns the
But didn't they come to an agreement on Atlantic Avenue where that horrible incident occurred?
They did.
I mean, they were drunk and running across the tracks.
They did. And it wasn't an easy agreement to reach. And it took some finagling because they had to figure out where we're going to put this, who's going to pay to construct it, and who's going to be on the hook to maintain it when something over time goes, you know, has to be done to it to keep it up. So, yeah, I think Delray, as a leading city in our part of the county, or in our part of the region, said that matters to us. We've had enough activity, enough illegal, unsafe behaviors to warrant finding a solution for this one block. 2 blocks, I want to say, just north and south of Atlanta. You know, the other thing I just want to say is we have worked quite a bit with the Brightline folks in the Operation Lifesaver program to try to promote our population's awareness of the safety issues associated with train crossings, the risks. And ultimately, the message is very simple. When the gates go down, don't go around them, don't go under them, don't put yourself in front of a train. But I still see it happen. And so anything you can do, any chance you have to just in your social circles, opportunities and conversation to reinforce that message. I mean, I was down at Northeast 2nd in Delray when we were there, just an hour before the meeting. I was 2 blocks north of Atlantic. I watched the gate go down. I watched a bicyclist approach that crossing, ride around the gate, across the tracks, and over the up to the other side. And he cleared the rail crossing about 3 seconds before the Brightline train passed through. 3 seconds. I mean, I was that close to watching a fatality. It was awful.
I think the worst is on Atlantic when, you know, it goes, it creeps. People just assume traffic's going to continue. And before you know it, you're stuck on the tracks.
Yes. Queuing on the major roads is a big challenge. And, yeah, part of the message for our drivers is don't enter that area unless you're sure you can exit. And that's hard.
I yell at my wife all the time.
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
But I need your help. And I've said the same thing to our news media. Is there anything we can do? Well, yes, there's a great deal of reminding we can do to our population. Just say, please respect those gates. Anyway, that's the update.
Okay. I think I used to work for a railroad, but until you stand next to the tracks, while that engine's going, that train's going by, that's 13 feet tall, 10 feet wide, and probably weighs a thousand tons.
Yeah.
You don't get an appreciation for the danger. You know, we used to stand 5 feet away from it. And it The other question is, in the newspaper lately, I've read that there is 84 crossings, as you said, but not all of them have extra safety apparatus added to the crossing to make it safer. In fact, I think in either Boynton or Delray, it's one of the crossings where somebody was killed.
Yeah.
Crossing the track.
Where we're not going to put any extra gates there.
Right.
That's right.
How is it determined which gates, which crossings would get gates, which crossings would, you know, the level all the way down to nothing?
So, first off, we had about $7 million available for this project. So we were given a budget. That's how much, that was the funding available in the year we needed it to build as many gates as we could, as well as improve pedestrian facilities and as many crossings as we could. But the gates are the key because the gates are what facilitate the quiet zone. That's what allows the quiet zone. So what we did is we looked at the 80 crossings and we calculated the risk of an incident at each of one of those crossings using the Federal Rail Administration's equation. They'd say, okay, plug in how many trains there are, how many train tracks there are, how many vehicle lanes there are, how many cars are driving across it, how many school buses, how many accidents have occurred in recent history in the last 5 years. They come up with a risk factor for every one of the crossings. We sorted it in descending order, and we did the ones that had the highest risk. And we distributed the funds as much as we could to each of the cities to ensure that every one of our cities was eligible for a quiet zone designation.
So, I'm sorry.
Is that the question? Okay.
So in that case, because I know there's a couple spots in Delray, if I'm not mistaken, that will not have the exit gate. So is that deemed a quiet zone?
Yes. So let me do my best job to explain the simple math of this. The whole corridor in a municipality, we'll just use Delray Beach as an example. There are 11 crossings in Delray Beach. There's a risk level associated with running trains across 11 roads in Delray Beach. But this risk is, say, here, when there's a train horn.
Right.
You take away the horn, and the average risk for those 11 crossings doubles. So then you look at the busiest ones, and you start adding gates and reducing the risks way back down at those locations. You do the first, the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth. Now I've spent enough money and reduced the risk enough so that my average without the horns but with the extra gates is below what it was throughout that corridor when the horns were blowing. So that's how we get, you're allowed to calculate the average of all of the crossings in a given segment. And you get to pick your segment. So that's what we did in Delray Beach. We said, this is how many crossings we're going to make improvements to. We've reduced the risk below what it would have been if there were no extra gates and the trains were blowing their horn.
So I think it would be smart to maybe put signs on those gates. That's
we put one of the requirements, well, what do you want the sign to say before I answer your question? I'm making an assumption of what you're suggesting.
Hey, student, don't go around the gates. No, but something to that effect.
Okay.
Like a quiet zone, you know, fast trains do not.
So one of the requirements of creating a quiet zone is that you have to place a sign at every crossing that the train will not blow its horn.
Right.
So we are providing that feedback, that information to the public. It doesn't go quite as far as what you're saying. Think tracks, or what is it, see tracks, think train,
right,
is one of the messages. And I'll just highlight the city of West Palm Beach is as a local government that's taking it a step farther and saying, hey, we need to provide some sort of additional reminder to our traveling public. They're painting, they just bought a stencil, and they're painting that message on the sidewalks at the crossings and saying, essentially, don't do something stupid, like go around the gates when they're down.
Right.
I mean, that helps with the pedestrian behavior.
Sure.
You won't read that in a car, but it'll help people walking.
This speculation of Boynton among some people is that the reason for the two deaths is because the freight trains were a lot slower. Now they got 79 mile an hour trains, and people aren't used to that. But I was traveling north and on I-95, and I looked at the tri-rail, and I was going 75, and we were staying even. So my question is, I think going through the cities, the maximum speed is like 80 miles an hour, so they go 79 and a half or something. How fast does tri-rail go?
Both rail corridors are given, they have established themselves as the same class of service, and I don't have the numbers memorized, but they're at the same level, essentially. The FEC now for passenger service and the South Florida Rail Corridor for tri-rail service. We which means both of those trains have a maximum operating speed of 79 miles per hour. So Brightline trains are not going any faster than Tri-Rail trains at their maximum operating speed. One of the potential differences is that Tri-Rail trains are traveling slower when they're approaching and pulling away from the frequent stops that they make in the corridor. So if some of your roadways are real close to stops, the train isn't going 79.
Right.
Whereas once Brightline pulls away from West Palm, it has a long stretch of corridor where it can run at its maximum speed.
Are there many deaths on Tri-Rail where it's going 75 miles an hour, or people are used to it now and it doesn't happen?
They set a record last year for deaths on the corridor.
They killed one or two people in Lentonville every year.
Rail crossings, by definition, are risky. Because, you know, as your chair mentioned, you're moving something with the momentum of a house at the speed of an uncongested freeway. You know, it's like getting hit by a house that's traveling at 79 miles per hour. When you add up all the mass behind that thing moving on the tracks, it's a big deal.
Right.
So, you know, Tri-Rail's train tracks, they've done quite a bit to make them as safe as they can. There's still more things that we're looking into. In fact, a couple of the crossings on Tri-Rail's corridor in Broward County have done what they call, the fancy name for it is dynamic envelope. Practically what they did was they painted the whole front of the crossing with a high visibility yellow paint on both sides so that cars rolling up to it will be reminded, this is a rail crossing, don't stop between these yellow bars. We can do things like that, and at the busiest crossings we are, because we want to make these things as safe as we possibly can.
Yes, you mentioned 84 crossings. Are these the crossings between West Palm Beach South?
Yes.
Eventually.
It's 80 crossings, I think. You said 84.
I think you said 80 and 34.
Yeah.
The point of my question is, you haven't yet considered the extension of Brightline North.
In fact, we have, and we've actually picked out the crossings to the north where we will install additional gates beyond what their project will be built, and we have allocated the funds for those. So one of the things we're doing right now is trying to work out an agreement with the railroads with Brightline to reimburse them for the construction of those northern additional gates. But what I want to remind everyone of is they're going to build them when their contractors up there in the North County do the work already, not before that. So even if we push them for a reimbursement agreement now, it's not going to accelerate the quiet zone in North County. But we do have the funds and we have the locations picked.
Just one more quick question, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You're saying that the gates are in tandem, they close not nose to nose, but side by side, so there's no gap?
Federal rule says you can have up to, I want to say, a foot and a half
gap
between the two. But don't quote me on that. It's a small space.
Yeah.
But they're intended to align. I will say, too, though, as far as operations go, you'll see the gate on the approach lane come down first, and then the gate on the departure lane will come down a few seconds, 7, 8, 9 seconds later. The idea is that if someone's coming the other way,
They clear
the first gate, we want to give them time to clear the second gate so we don't trap people in between the two.
And you did say that there's going to be signs where they don't blow the horn, or they're going to be both signs, we blow the horn or we don't blow the horn.
Every crossing that is within a quiet zone has to have a sign on it that says train does not blow horn. So even if that crossing doesn't have the continuous gates, it will have that sign.
Okay.
Is it the right or on the thing?
It's primarily there for the vehicles,
so will
but it's
not
also
horn?
For the pedestrians. No, it's a posted static sign. It doesn't move. It's just one of those angle iron, you know, stick it in the ground. And
hopefully they see it.
Yeah. Well, we hope that a lot with all of our road signs. To the lesser and greater extent, we're successful.
The other thing is that when you have double track, like tri-rail, you've got trains moving both directions.
Yeah, that's right.
So you can have one get out of the way,
yeah,
and if they don't pay attention, the one coming the opposite way comes.
Yeah. We encountered the other night in Atlanta,
play.
And you can saw them like a couple minutes apart.
So that's really the biggest odds you want, right? Doubling your odds, you're only one thing.
Thank you.
I'm going to run through this one for you. I just want to remind everyone, Unified Planning Work Program, or UPWP, is the federal...
Oh, wait, I got one more question.
Sure.
I'm sorry. So on the, April, the municipalities are allowed to, around there, be able to put forward, submit proposals. What is, given the newness of this, right, it's kind of, they're shocking. I mean, I ain't even one day long on park, from the track. I'm fine with quiet zones, but on the flip side, obviously our mayor came out and was like, I actually prefer the high signs right now, so people can get it.
Yeah.
What's the county's take on that? Do they prefer the quiet zones? Do they not care? Is it better to keep the horns so people are more aware at this point in time? So what's the position now?
Well, our county commissioner, I'm going to speculate, is glad they don't have to answer that question, because they're not one of the local governments that has to file one of these notices.
Sure. I'm just thinking from a safety perspective.
That being said, my governing board, the 21 elected officials on the TPA, said it was important enough to allocate federal transportation funds to allow for our cities to designate the portion of their portion of the corridor as a quiet zone. So they voted to spend $7.5 million on these additional safety improvements to allow a quiet zone to be possible. That's a pretty big vote.
Right.
Yeah, that's a pretty strong commitment to facilitating the quiet zone.
Safe answer. Thank you.
Well, I can only tell you what they vote on, because that's how groups make decisions. Okay. UPWP, it's our agency's budget. It tells us, it's our way of telling our federal funding partners, Federal Highway and Federal Transit, what we want to work on, what we want to work on planning for, and how much we'd like to spend. So I want to give you that context. This is an important document for me because it sets the budget I have to work with to pay my staff and to pay our consultants and to do all the other transportation planning work that we do in the county. And once I click this on, it will work. There we go. Again, it's our business plan, and it's our application for federal funds. It's a two-year document. It covers 2 years on the state's fiscal calendar. So it starts July 1 of 2018, and it goes through June 30th of 2020. And it does cover our staff expenses, our consultant services. It identifies what we're going to accomplish, what those things are going to look like, and when we hope to finish them. Big picture overview of our seven categories of expenditure. We, first of all, engage the public, and you guys have talked quite a bit about that, our public participation plan and monitoring the effectiveness of that plan, reaching out to people, and I love this saying, and I don't even remember who to attribute it to, but I'm fond of the quote, the government has no resources to offer the people except what's first taken from them. And so part of our job is to reach out to the public to help them understand that we are deciding how to spend the gas taxes they pay at the pump. And we want their input to make sure we spend those well. The majority of our funding goes into planning. We are the planning agency for the county. So we are doing a lot of planning for the system. And we are prioritizing our funds, implementing or supporting the implementation of projects, making sure that they're being built consistent with our plans. We're collaborating with our partners, with the DOT, with the county, with the cities, with the transit operators. We do administer the agency, so we've got some line item tasks for that. And then we also are, this year, for the first time, requesting each one of the governing entities that have voting membership on our board to make a member dues payment. And one of the questions that came up when we talked about that with our elected officials in February was, exactly what are you going to spend my dues on? We're asking for 10 cents per capita. It's not a significant number in my perspective, but it's more than zero, which is what they've been paying. And so in that respect, it is a significant number. It amounts to about $130,000 annually. And I'll show you a little bit more about what we hope to accomplish with that. High level, just referencing a couple of the tasks in each one of the, or a couple of the items in each one of these tasks. Again, number one is engage the public. It's our outreach, it's our web, it's our social media. And anything you think of that we can be doing to more effectively collect input and inform the public and engage the public in how to make sure we're spending dollars that on projects that our communities are excited about would go into this task. This is an important one for this committee. We want your help making sure we're doing strategic things and doing them well. planning the system, I'll highlight that we're doing our long-range transportation plan update. We are also committing, as you requested and our board adopted, that we will be putting a Vision Zero action plan in front of them, saying, okay, you've said you have zero as your target for fatalities and serious injuries. What do we have to do differently to move toward that outcome? Modal network planning is a fancy way to say we're going to look at our bicycle network, we're going to look at our sidewalk network, we're going to look at our street lighting, we're going to look at our freight demands. We're not just looking at the vehicular system for cars. And then corridor studies are specific projects that we would identify, like the US 1 studies, like the Okeechobee Boulevard study that we're going to work on and we're going to lead through this agency. Want to mention this briefly. Local studies, I think on the liaison report, we did provide you with a list of the projects that were submitted for our transportation alternatives and local initiatives programs just last Friday. One of the things that we've done is to create a partnership through the Treasure Coast Regional Planning Council where we can help our local cities that maybe don't have as many planning dollars or resources or staff to still come up with good ideas to submit for projects. And I'll mention to you and the committee, and we would love to hear any suggestions you have for how we can move this needle. We tend to see the same municipalities submit for those programs, and what we really like to do is help our smaller cities also pursue funding for projects in their communities. So that's what this program is here for. It's a 50-50 match. We would say to a city that came to us, like a North Palm Beach, and we did this just last year, they came and said, hey, we'd love to do a village master plan for our major roadways to kind of get a feel for what they could become so we can be better positioned to submit a project to you for funding for construction. We said, great, we'll pay half the cost, up to $50,000. They said, all right, the cost for our study is about $130,000. They paid $80,000, we paid $50,000, they got a really nice document that loaded the pipeline for them with a couple of project suggestions. We want to do that with more cities, especially cities that are not large enough to do this well on their own. Prioritizing funding, that's our transportation improvement program. It tells us what we're going to spend the money on, and then also our priority projects list, the major projects, the local initiatives, transportation alternatives, and then a new component to that priority list that we're going to add this year, projects that we think are necessary to improve safety for all users. This is part of our Vision Zero action plan. We're going to try to get that ball rolling this year, and we're going to flesh out some of the details in that action plan later this year. On the project implementation side, we are going to commit to measuring our progress against the values in our long-range plan, as well as any federal requirements like safety or like health of the system, bridge health, pavement condition, stuff like that. We also use our congestion management process to annually report to the board on the health of our transportation system. We give them a scorecard. And then lastly, we use this task to, for lack of a better word, meddle in the agency implementation of roadway and transit projects. So we'll go to the county engineering group and say, hey, couldn't you do this and this and this? And we'll go to the DOT and say, why don't you paint those bike lanes green while you're out there? Stuff like that. That's where we engage in the implementation process and try to convince people to do just a little bit more than they would have done if we hadn't shown up. Task 5, collaborative partners. We have a regional partnership with my counterparts to the south, Broward and Miami-Dade MPOs. We call that CESTEC, or the Southeast Florida Transportation Council. We also do quite a bit with other partner agencies. We have a community transportation safety team with the DOT, and a lot of work with our school board and Safe Routes to School efforts. And then as far as ad hoc working groups go, I'll mention just two, the Complete Streets Work Group and then the road impact fee or mobility fee conversation. And then training, I know we mentioned in the liaison report, we are doing a workshop next week on the implementation of Complete Streets, and that's on Wednesday all day. Administering the agency is us just running these meetings, making sure that we submit the invoices for the expenses that we incurred, get reimbursed by our federal partners. And one of the keys on this one too is this independent agency transition plan. So as we're moving toward becoming an independent agency, we're gonna be putting a lot of the expenses for that under this category, finding a new office space, making sure the meeting facilities are adequate, making sure that we can provide best possible transportation planning services to the public. Then we get to the local funds. So what are we telling our elected officials? that we could accomplish if they paid member dues that we can't do today. Primarily, it's advocacy. That's a no-no with federal reimbursement funds. We're not allowed to do anything like that. We can't go to Tallahassee and say, wouldn't it be great if you made texting while driving a primary offense? I don't get paid to do that. They won't reimburse me for that. But if I have a local member dues contribution, then all of a sudden I can pay a lobbyist for it, or I can travel, or our board can travel and be paid those expenses out of this pot of money. Same thing if we go for a discretionary grant up in Washington. If we said, hey, we'd love to see Tri-Rail service go up to North Palm Beach County, wouldn't it be great if we got a New Starts grant? I'm not allowed to go up to Washington and talk to the federal transit folks about our project, but if I have this funding source, now I have an opportunity to go and do that. Frankly, all of our counterparts that are successful in pursuing those kinds of discretionary funds have established this approach, and we think it's a progressive way to engage and empower our agency to be as effective as possible. We also have a line item budget for promotional items and activities like our Bike to Work ride, like our Sage Street Summit, some of those handouts that we do, giveaways that promote awareness of our transportation system but don't directly get input. We're not allowed to reimburse those items, so this gives us a local funding source to do that. Non-reimbursable expenses like the coffee and the water and the refreshments we provide at the meetings, sponsorship support, and then balance to our TPA reserve fund, understanding that we're guessing, you know, back to Myron's point, we've rounded out. The only reason I have 640 down here is because I had to add up to the total 10 cents times the number of people in the county, but everything else is to the nearest thousand, because we know these are not precise numbers.
We don't know the number of people in the county to have.
Yeah.
And that's only six numbers, not seven, so you're fine.
That's right. we're presenting this as a draft. We're going to be bringing it back for final recommendation at the May committee meetings and then final adoption at our board, or May board meeting. We are very interested in anything you think we ought to be working on that we're not, and anything, essentially anything you want us to add into this document, because this is what we're going to try to accomplish. And if you have an idea, you can tell it to me now through this discussion, or you can also reach out to Renee and send her your notes, and we'll try our best to incorporate your suggestions. Mr. Chair, that's all I have.
Okay. Question?
Terry? Are all of the municipalities or entities that sit on the board contributing into this effort? I mean, are they going to make the financial commitment?
The member dues?
Yeah.
So last month, our board, first of all, it's only for governmental entities with voting membership. So it's just the 13 cities, the county, and the port. It's not all 39 cities that we're asking for dues from. Now, those 13 cities and the unincorporated area population together comprise 95% of our total population. So we get the majority of the people, but we're only asking for dues payments from our voting members.
But there are some municipalities that are not on the board.
Correct.
And they don't have to
pay
the fee.
They won't have to pay
it. But they can make application for these benefits.
Yes, because...
And there won't be any prejudice that they're small and they're not giving money.
Well, no, because we have an objective scoring system that reviews every application submitted to us for funding. And one of those objective criteria is not, did you make your dues payment this year?
That was my point.
Yes, that's correct. And frankly, we have funded projects in municipalities that are not on our boards that we proactively sought them out for and said, hey, Village of Tequesta, DOT is doing a resurfacing job. Wouldn't it be great if we added a little bit of money to that and made it a complete street project in your city? And the mayor said, absolutely, I would love that. I didn't even know that was a possibility. Same kind of conversation in North Palm, similar conversation in Lantana with a different outcome. We went to Lantana and said, hey, Lantana, we have a great idea for US 1 in your city. Wouldn't it be great if we took away one of the through lanes, provided a center turn lane so you're a safer place for turning vehicles, and introduced bicycle facilities and a sidewalk? And Lantana said, no, that'll make us get stuck in traffic. We don't want anything to do with that. Go away. Okay, well, you're not on our board. We're not prejudiced for you or against you. We just thought it was a good idea, and if you don't want it, then I get it. So, my point is, we're in the business of planning countywide with blindness to the jurisdictional boundaries of our members. So we don't think that this member dues payment concept is going to bias our decisions at all.
The other question I had was regarding your management of the agency. And do you feel confident that you have sufficient resources, such as salary resources and benefits, to keep the good employees and also to recruit people and to give them pay raises? Is that something you are able to do?
So the answer to the question, do we have sufficient resources, is yes. The answer to the question, do we have sufficient, do I have sufficient authority to use those resources subject to the approval of my governing board as they direct? The answer is no. And the reason we're doing this transition to an independent agency is because the county government wants us to operate according to the county administrator's policies and procedures, and that kind of ties my hands on being able to pay our staff competitive to what other agencies like me in Broward, in Miami, in Orlando, in Tampa, in Jacksonville are able to pay their employees.
So someday you hope to break free of that, or?
So we are actively working to transition this agency from being hosted by Palm Beach County to being independent. Ideally, this time next year, I will have a great deal of progress, if not an outcome, to demonstrate that commitment. But I hope you do,
because this agency is going to be more important in the future. The future needs to come to us in terms of planning and transportation problems and transit problems, and it's going to be very valuable. So.
And I appreciate that. Yeah. Frankly, we've been very fortunate to attract people like Andrew, people like Bowery, people like Melissa, to this agency who really care about investing in transportation. I want to pay them well enough that they don't want to care about it in Tampa. I want them to invest in this part of the state and make this their home and make the difference that they have the potential of making here, not somewhere else.
Well, we're rooting for you.
It's the name change.
Appreciate that. Well, yeah, and the branding, the name change and whatnot, the branding is all part of this transitional process.
So you mentioned, I don't know if this is appropriate, but you mentioned it, and so I'm going to bring it up. Like one of those things from a lobbying effort, being able to...
I have to stop you for a second. I did not intentionally permit Marge or Alexa. I had tunnel vision for a moment, and I just was looking here. But I didn't want to negatively imply anything for the. I'm sorry.
You get a pay raise. No, I'm just kidding.
Then you mentioned being able to lobby, for example, parents tax-free. Is there the stomach to even just go this step further and just go hands-free?
Well, I'm using examples, but our governing board has not established its own set of legislative and policy positions. So your question has to do with what would make it onto that list, and I think there's a stomach for that potentially, but I won't know until there's a vote.
So who do we contact to move that forward?
Well, 2 years ago, I tried to get a legislative and policy positions, single page kind of elevator speech adopted by our governing board. I wasn't able to facilitate consensus on the outcome, and part of the governing board's reason was, why are we fighting about this? You can't do anything with this piece of paper once we approve it anyway. Don't make me fight with my friends.
Right.
So I think there's reason to fight. We need to align. We need to identify what matters to us as part of the state and decide, let's go make a difference on these issues. And the tighter alignment we can create, the more likely we are to make a difference. Your question is a little more detailed than I'm ready to answer, though.
Okay. Let's talk more about it, just because sure. To me, I don't understand why we just go to baby steps when so many organizations within the U.S. went for a complete hands-free.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Along the same line, I think Tallahassee, they have a bill actually moving through right
they
now.
They do?
Yes.
And what's that bill?
It was Emily Schlossberg.
House Bill 33. Emily Schlossberg.
Yeah. So.
Very compelling history.
Maybe.
To her as well.
Is that just texting or?
It has to do with texting and driving. So I know.
I don't think that bill goes as far as prohibiting all hands-free.
No, it does.
It's taking you from a secondary offense to a primary.
Right.
Right.
text number.
You can reach out to her, because she, I know she's a huge advocate.
What's her name?
Emily Flossberg.
Emily Flossberg, she's a housewife.
S-L-O-S-B-E-R-G, House Bill 32.
Right, okay, thank you.
Flossberg.
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 S-L-O-G. Flossberg.
Good, awesome, thank you. There we go.
All right, thank you. My question.
Yes, I'm just curious, what does it cost to sustain the citizens advisory committee every year? Since you've been dealing with budgets.
And us.
Well, candidly, we aggregate as many categories as we can so that I don't ground in minutia. So I don't know. I mean, it, you know, depends on what you allocate to this lineup. Is it all the staff costs in the room? Is it the, you know, the electric bill and the coffee pot? It's not substantial.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's not. Well, when I can take this back to LA, you know, it's, to me, I think pretty valuable because it's extra messaging that maybe you don't have reach for.
Yes, that's part of my ask. I mean, when I did this presentation this morning, I said to all of our committee members, hey, when your elected officials ask you, is this a good idea or not? I want you to have enough information to say, yes, we value this organization and we want to maximize its effectiveness. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps a lot.
Along the same line, I know the Solid Music for Early Citizens Advisory Committee, they actually give the representative for each commission mileage. Just so you know, just throwing that out there.
Okay.
So you can add to your budget if you're asking them to pay the
fees. Okay. So,
it's not a lot.
11 cents instead of 10.
Yeah, first.
Okay. Thank you. Five months.
We have Alyssa from our staff who's going to meet.
Hi everyone, my name is Alyssa Murray. I am going to briefly go over for Bike Month activities in Palm Beach County.
Thank you.
So, and Marge is handing out the handout with all of the list of all of the events that are actually going on. So far we have a total of 5 proclamations countywide. So that would be the city of West Palm Beach, Boca Raton, Green Acres, Palm Beach County, and we are doing ours at the board meeting on Thursday. If I missed any, and anyone in here is aware of any other proclamations going on in your municipalities, it would be great if you could let me know so I can add it on to what we have. And so a bunch of activities that are going on. The first two passed actually on Friday and Saturday, but this coming Saturday, there's a bunch of things going on. Westgate's doing an annual bike rodeo, Lake Worth is doing hand cycling clinic, Boca Raton is doing the bicycle ride with the mayor, Royal Palm Beach is doing a bike trail rodeo, Palm Springs is also doing a bike trail rodeo, and Jupiter is doing a guided pedal, and then there's activities in the city of West Palm Beach. Monday through Friday is for bike week, so it's going to actually conclude on Friday, March 16th, so next Friday, with an elected official bike ride there's 3 rides, which we will go over in a second, but it will be an elected official ride. So these are the activities for Bike to Work Week in West Palm Beach. So Monday is it's a kickoff day. Party, I think, is 11:30 to 1:30. All of the times are also on these sheets in front of you. Tuesday is Bike to Vote, to really encourage everyone to get out there and vote and be active about it. Bikes and Movies at Subculture Coffee in downtown West Palm Beach on Wednesday. And Friday is Bike to Work Day. So join a group, there's 3, for a ride that will end at City Hall. So those are the 3 routes there. The first one coming from the west is going to start at the Target on Palm Beach Lakes, going to City Hall. And then the elected official ride and the Palm Beach TPA ride is going to start at the Mangonia Park Tri-Rail Station and conclude at City Hall. And then coming from the south, it's from the South Olive Community Center ending at City Hall. And we will also, if anyone is interested in riding, we will be doing having shirts for anyone participating. So if you want to reserve a shirt and you can do it, let me know so I can reserve a size for you.
And our ed?
Yes, for our ed, not for the other eds. And we have our calendar updated on the Bike Palm Beach website. So bike month activities and really all Bike Palm Beach activities will be up there and should be up to date. And if anyone knows of any activities that are not listed on here in any cities, please let me know so I can add them onto the calendar. And if there's any questions, I'll take them.
Just that there's no mention or emphasis on electric bicycles. Is there any plan that you know of where people organize tours with electric bikes? As you know, Trek and Pedego and all of these bike makers, we own Pedego, but they're expensive.
Yeah.
Right off the bat.
Well, everything for Bike Week, I mean, I'm sure you can bring, if you have an electric bike, you can bring it. But everyone that's doing it, for the most part, people are bringing their own bike. So if they have an electric bike, they can participate. I'm not sure if...
So you haven't heard of any special tours?
No.
We haven't heard of any tours or plans. Last year, I don't recall the name of the electric bike company, but there was a gentleman that showed up with a couple electric bikes and let people test them out at the start of the ride. But in general, it's just regular bikes and maybe some Sky bikes from Bike Share.
But all over the country, they use electric bikes for people to go to work. It's something that you should emphasize.
I think they're great. I see on my commute, there's this one guy, I'm down in Boca, and there's a guy that rides on Miller Tiger Trail every morning and every afternoon on his little electric bike.
Yeah. You get to plug it in when you get where you are, and by the time you finish work, you go home. Yeah.
Definitely one way to do it.
Any member additional comments? Next meeting is April the 4th, and we need a motion to adjourn.
Excuse me, I was just going to remind you that a notice was sent out yesterday. Alexa sent you guys a notice about how we're hoping to include profiles in our upcoming newsletter, so if you all would follow up with that. And then also, I will walk outside out front. And a few of you, if you're not in a huge rush, if you'll give me a chance in natural light to take a headshot of you real quickly that we can use when your time comes around, that would be great. If we don't get your picture today, we'll do it next month. There's a month after.
That's why I dress a little better.
If you have a professional one, a good one you want to send to us, you can do that too.
Any other comments? Motion to
adjourn? I just think to express appreciation to the staff for the committee's recommendation to the board, because the board actually adopted it.
Right.
The recommendation is one of the action plan for the Vision Zero. And we should note that the board actually did something that we asked them to do.
Zero reduced accidents. Okay. Motion to adjourn.
Second.
I need a motion.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.